Ladies and gentlemen, Madame's Messieurs, welcome back to a brand new 2-Bit Podcast. We're welcoming back the mighty, the powerful Thomas 777. How are you, sir?
I'm well, man. How are you? Thanks for hosting me.
Oh, my pleasure. Are we going to continue the peeing in the sink conversation, or are we just going to go right into the
conversation? I'm not a sink peer, man. Like that, like I said, like that's demoralizing. It's existentially corrupt. I'm about peeing it outside.
Outdoors on the grass only. Like I said, only if I'm brushing my teeth.
We'll kick it over to the chat. We'll kick two questions out of the chat. Are maintaining your front lawns more of a white supremacist Aryan? Is the most white supremacist Aryan thing you can do in this day and age? Is peeing in the sink degeneracy? Let us know in the chat. We will read out your comments as they come in. As always, we're available on YouTube, Rumble. Tried doing it on Kick, but it's not working on Kick for some reason. Twitter, X, whatever you want to call it, and all your local podcatchers. Okay, so
it's officially Thomas. X, formerly known as Twitter. Always must.
Yeah, no, this is true. Thomas, we've invited you on to come talk about Alexander Dugin's The Great Awakening and the Great Reset. We got a reading set up, but to start, any opening volleys about Comrade Dugin or Herr Dugin, depending on how you view him. Go ahead.
He's a compelling guy. I know some people don't take him seriously. But I think of him, he kind of fills the role, in my opinion, Alain de Benoist, you know, the guy he wrote on being a pagan and all of that. The Greece think tank, GRECE, or Grace, I'm terrible with pronunciations. You know, in the 80s and 90s, Benoist was kind of the leading intellectual of the third position, when there actually was a third position. I don't like it when people invoke that term today because it doesn't make sense outside of the Cold War paradigm. But I think Dugin fills a similar role. I think a lot of people mistake what his angle is, because they what the kind of punitive critiques of him suggest, well, this is not practical thinking, but Dugin's not, that's not his jive. You know, he's very much a conceptual theorist. And I think he's basically right. If Russia is going to not just survive, but if Russia is going to be able to assert itself on the world stage in power political terms, that's essentially a cultural paradigm that's going to facilitate that. You know, a highly politicized cultural paradigm, but a cultural one nonetheless. And his ideas in that regard are sound. I'm not going to speak to some critiques, people, Levy Adam, because it's not my heritage. I mean, I know that there's Orthodox guys who have their own objections. I mean, that's not for me to weigh in on. But I think he's an important thinker. And frankly, I mean, not being flippant, I believe the murder of his daughter, which is horrible. I mean, I can't even imagine what Dugin and his wife are enduring on the grounds of that tragedy. But I think it's quite clear that bomb was meant for Dugin. Okay. And there is some truth to that. And again, not to be flippant, but if Dugin was just a nobody, like, no one would be bothering to try to murder him. You know, I mean, he doesn't have a following he's not setting himself up as, you know, some kind of challenger to the United Russia monopoly on power. And nor would that be a practical thing to pursue anyway, but he does, his ideas are monumentally impactful within, you know, kind of the insular Russian discourse about, you know, what on conceptual and philosophical things. And Russia is a more philosophically driven society than most. I think that that's, yeah, I mean, even somebody who's not got no fluency in Russian and doesn't have any particular insight into the culture can see that. So, I mean, we're, for better or worse, Dugin's a significant guy. I mean, that's always been my kind of read on him. And I think he very much is in the tradition of Solzhenitsyn, but obviously he's more of like a hard political theorist than, you know, more of kind of like a cultural critic and whatever than Solzhenitsyn was. But yeah, he's an important guy, man, I think.
Yeah, I think one of the things, Dugin was always on my periphery, that I read a lot of things about him, but never really read him. So the great this book is more of a smaller primer for his bigger work,
right?
Which is the fourth political theory, which I've kind of skimmed, but I haven't gone in depth with. I think the importance with Dugin for Westerners, or for anyone who wants to think outside the liberal frame, is that he's one of the few modernists who are attacking the liberal frame full on, head on. Like he's trying to break it completely. He's not trying to hold on to anything, any little bits of it. The only criticism I'd have of him is that he still seems to be holding on to a little bit of the revolutionary spirit, which is, I think,
that's inevitable in Russia. I mean, Russia's political culture, like modern Russia, owes to its establishment, its establishing of occurrence was the Bolshevik Revolution. So there's always going to be trappings of revolutionary and basically communistic sensibilities within that paradigm. I mean, that's why, like, Zhuganov's reconstituted Russian Communist Party, they're like openly Orthodox. You know, they're not racialist, but they're very much they very much look at themselves as, you know, the stewards of the Russian culture and like the posterity of the Russian people as a race. I mean, not so much in biological terms, but as a historical phenomenon and as like a linear natal cultural phenomenon. This is like a priority of theirs. You know, it's very much a left Hegelian paradigm, but without the dialectical materialism, if that makes any sense. So I think that's somewhat inevitable, and like I agree with you. But again, I find Russian political theory post Cold War to be really kind of strange. I don't mean that in like to be mean or something, but Westerners are going to find it somewhat, and non Russians are going to find it somewhat alien, I think.
One thing I think a lot of Westerners simply do not understand about Slavs, and I'll say Slavs in general, Russians, Poles, Ukrainians, etc., is that by and large, and this might have something to do with that, some sort of leftover from the Turkish influence, it's very black and white culture, especially when it comes down to problems, say. If you look at how Putin addressed the Chechen situation, let's say, it's like problem, no problem. We guess all of them and we sort it out. You know, like, it's very, I think Westerners are always trying, especially with postmodernism and everything else that's going on the left, in sort of the left Western sphere, they're trying to convince themselves they can exist in this part of grayness, where in the Eastern European mindset there is no grayness on certain levels. It's very like this is this and that is that and that's all there is to it. You brought up the Orthodox kind of situation. There's a lot of Western Orthodox people who don't want to deal with Byzantium, who right. kind of want to imagine Orthodoxy without Byzantium. And
just this kind of like, just like this kind of ethereal thing that, you know, is like culturally present, but not politically impactful or.
Right. Or, I mean, this we often get into conversations. I had this is a personal thing, but there was a bit of a hoo-ha on Orthodox Twitter about the death penalty, and someone's claiming that you can't be Orthodox and be supportive of the death penalty, which is like, well, that's not accurate historically or otherwise. And again, you get back to Byzantium, you're like, well, here's all these other things that prove you wrong. So I think in the Eastern European mind, and especially with Dugin, he's talking on civilizational terms, which is something that I think is very foreign to the Western mindset. But that's how you break liberalism essentially out of your brain a little bit and step aside from it, is to look at this on civilizational terms. And that gives you a viewpoint from way up high that I don't think many other thinkers, at least that I'm aware of, modernist thinkers, are attempting to do.
No, so. And that's why Dugin's worth reading. And again, I mean, I'm like a redneckish American prod. You know, I'm like as kind of non-Slavic as can be, or like non-ethnic as can be, if you want to look at it in those kinds of terms. But Dugin, I mean, aside from the fact that, you know, like I said, I think he, in contemporary terms, just going to the world situation, he's a significant guy. But no, his stuff is all, it's Carl Schmitt, Heidegger, Hegel. I mean, that's the kind of stuff people should be reading if you're a partisan of any stripe against the regime, you know, because if nothing else, you know, Dugan has a good understanding of the canon, and you know, it helps to put it in perspective. You know, even if his conceptual horizon is totally different than yours or mine, or you know, or whoever else's. Yeah, mm-hmm. Very much agree.
Sorry to interject. I don't know what your setup is there, Thomas, but we're getting an echo on your end. Are you using monitors?
No, I just got my condenser mic and
sounds fine on my end, but
yeah, right, it's not bad, but it's there. Just if it's
I'm hearing it coming through on your end, but no, I'm not doing anything different.
Okay.
Okay, so should we get to the reading? Are we good for that? This is we'll be picking up from where we left off with Tommy Sammons last week, sort of the middle of section two, where he's talking about Dugan's talking about Trump and sort of the Trump effect. And I do have my daughter here, so if you hear cuteness from my right hand side, we'll just have to deal with that. She's got cartoons. She's got a headphone. She got gifted headphones recently, which has been just like. Thank you, BB. Okay. And as always, please cut in. Tell me to stop if I'm going too fast.
Just go slow. Just
let me know.
Yeah,
go as slow as I can. So, Trumpism. Trump rode a wave of populism in 2016 that no other European leader has managed to do. Trump thus became a symbol of opposition to liberal globalism. Yes, it was not an alternative ideology, but merely a desperate resistance to the last conclusions drawn from the logic and even metaphysics of liberalism and nominalism. Trump was not at all challenging capitalism or democracy, but only the forms they had taken in their latest stage and their gradual consistent implementation. But even this was enough to mark a fundamental split in American society. This is how the phenomenon of Trumpism took shape. A second here. Pause for the cuteness. This is how the phenomenon of Trumpism took shape, in many ways exceeding the scale of Donald Trump's own personality. Trump played on the anti-globalization protest wave, but it is clear that he was not and is not an ideological figure. And yet, it was around him that the opposition bloc began to form.
Yeah, I mean, that, just to jump in there, that's the one thing that always sort of...
Sorry, my daughter just gave out the most massive fart right next to me. I'm trying to... Sorry, go ahead, talk. Talk amongst yourselves.
Yeah, I'll be right back. Choke it out there. I was always shocked by what I think he's saying there, or at least alluding to, was that the freak-out opposition to Trump and how unrelated it was to his actual... policies or even talking points.
Well, the way to understand it, Trump has to be understood in context of the redrawing of political alliances in America in 1968. Okay. When LBJ and the Great Society Coalition like went full on for forced integration, and the South revolted. You know, the Dixiecrats went for Wallace. That destroyed what had been the New Deal coalition, and it totally redrew the political map, because then a truly like white national politic emerged. And Nixon was able to appropriate that coalition. Okay. But Nixon himself, I mean, Nixon was probably the only post-war president, like really who was really like worthy of the office. But Nixon was not this like right-wing guy. Okay, right. I mean, he had a very conciliatory view of race relations. He took a firm stance against forced busing, but I mean, a lot of people did, and that was gross overreach, you know. And it was acknowledged as gross overreach even by people on the other side of the aisle. But the regime went utterly berserk about Nixon because the silent majority coalition, they viewed that as something existentially dangerous. Okay. The Reagan coalition was the Wallace Nixon coalition as well, but in my opinion, I mean, Reagan wasn't called the great communicator for nothing. Like Reagan, the man was able to finesse and mitigate, and come to terms with the opposition in a way that Nixon wasn't, but also like the Cold War paradigm. America was actively losing the Cold War in military terms when Reagan took office. Okay, so there's an existential variable there too that was a game changer. But what Trump is he's the Nixon, the Wallace Nixon Reagan, MAGA is the Wallace Nixon Reagan coalition, what remains of it in the 21st century. Okay. And because there's an increasingly non-white, increasingly radicalized, radicalizable, and increasingly like literally senile kind of regime in place, they don't know how to deal with it. Like mm-hmm. all they can do is like shriek and scream and try to criminalize opposition rather than incorporating it into the negotiating structure. Like that's what it is. You know, what they do is they engage in these kinds of like superstitious ritual condemnations of Trump, these like hysterical declarations that he's evil, you know, the like indictment after indictment after indictment, you know, show trials, you know, it's very primitive. It's very late Soviet in some way. Mm-hmm. But the problem is that, and that's also what they've been habituated to, because I mean, really since 1933, like they've gotten their way. Cause I mean, the regime itself is a revolutionary coterie. It's just no longer competent. Like the men who've inherited it, post 1989. I mean, part of it's just the competency crisis that is across the board in, elite quarters. But part of it also is that competent men just don't want anything to do with government after 1989. Like why would they, you know, yeah. It lost its raison d'etre after the Cold War, and it became a repository of just kind of like losers and like clout chasers and people quite literally looking for ways to get rich who didn't really have a skill set to accomplish that in any actually productive way. So that's what it is. Go ahead.
But is Trump actually a threat to the fundamentals of this order? Like that's the disconnect.
Trump himself isn't, but that doesn't matter because the regime refuses to abide the demands of the Trump of the Trump coalition. You know, so all they can do is shriek that it's evil, it's unacceptable, and try to other it. But that's all the regime knows how to do. But the problem is you can't other 70 million people. You can't claim that like half the adult electorate are just bad people. Like it's not. I mean, that
you can claim it. They did.
It's entitled stupid, but it's also not workable. Yeah. You know, and that's one of the reasons why a lot of these problems are going to take care of themselves. Like I'm always encouraging people to not get invested in this garbage, like regime garbage. I mean, for all kinds of reasons, because it's axiomatically hostile to us. Like, why would we want to fuck with it anyway? But beyond that, it's pissing away like any legitimacy that it has. You know, it's what's America do? It's got like sanctions imposed on half of the countries on this planet. It's shrieking that, you know, like 70 or 80 million people in this country are evil and their views are illegitimate. You know, it's got this doddering old fairy like in the White House who doesn't even know what day it is, who just periodically mumbles about like how awesome sodomy is and how we're all racist. I mean, like, that's literally a joke.
Yeah, and they don't even have, according to at least my own observation, they don't have the majority by any stretch.
No, right? And they don't even hold elections anymore. Right. You know, like they've abolished elections. You know, and just I mean, it's positively third world. You know, I mean, it's the Soviet Union of 1989 minus the vestigial competence and the seriousness of. Some of the apparatchiks.
Well, I was just thinking this the other day. Interesting you bring that up, because what was interesting about the Soviet Union, especially late stage Soviet Union, they had massive amounts of corruption, and the communications were screwed up because everyone was afraid of stepping out. It was the old, they pretend to pay us, we pretend to work. But they didn't have the competency crisis that we now have in the West, because they they were still training people. People were still very, very intelligent, well-read, well-trained, all the rest of it. It's just the system around them had crumbled to a point where no one was buying in anymore. What we have now in the West, and I can say this, you know, living in the vestigial arm of Australia, we see it here too, where you're having a competency crisis that is biting everyone in the ass, where you now have too many favored hires, you have too much corruption in every single branch and every single entity, that now you don't have competent people running things. And you're going to start seeing, you know, airplanes falling from the sky because the people just forget how to freaking fly. Like, you know, or you're having people, you know, people with minus 90 IQs making your planes. That's a problem.
Well, yeah. I mean, you're seeing it in policy terms. I mean, that's what Lavrov is always talking about. When, I mean, aside from everything else that's fundamentally morally corrupt, as well as just strategically illiterate about America's proxy war against Russia and Ukraine, like these people in the State Department are fucking morons, you know, they're not joking, you know, and this isn't some like 40 chess sort of like angle. They really are like complete fucking morons, and their idea is, you know, like slapping sanctions on everybody on this planet, like pointing and shrieking at the Kremlin that you're evil because you're like bad guys and stuff. That's like literally their view of the world. They have no understanding of politics. They have no understanding of war and peace. They've got no understanding of the constellation of variables that give rise to situations like exists in Russia, Ukraine, like zero at all. You know, it's like, it's like somebody who, it'd be like somebody who can't perform long division functions, like sitting down and trying to scribble out like advanced calculus, you know, like, so that's going to have consequences. I mean, it's already having consequences. You know, like, I mean, America, I don't even think, and the Soviet Union, too, to your point, the Soviet Union, it owed its superpower status to the fact, to hard power. Okay, it had arguably the mightiest military apparatus on this planet.
That was never used.
Yeah, but, not in direct terms, but very, but the point is, like, they, you know, if everything else aside, like the Soviet Union was, it could project hard power in a way that was utterly devastating, and it could do so to great effect, you know, and it proved that in 1945 and in the world by the proxy war, again, too, by the detente era, the Soviet Union was winning the Cold War militarily. It didn't matter that the Soviet Union was a basket case and it was dysfunctional kinds of other ways, but like America doesn't even have that. Like, I don't believe America has a real power projection capability in hard power terms. Like, I don't, you know, like it's got like the people in the Pentagon, they're as fucked up as these State Department idiots. Probably half of them like are female impersonators or like other like insane people. Like they, you know, and it's also, you know, it's not like, you know, like I made the point of people before, like when people tell me I was an idiot for saying that like Russia will be able to weather whatever America throws at it. I'm like, look, unless Biden can put in a call to Berlin, demand that the Bundeswehr mobilize and prepare for total war against Russia, and simultaneously implement a general draft and military age males, then deploy in depth, then assault Russia with, if necessary, nuclear, biological, and chemical weapons, and not stop until Moscow falls, like, you're not doing shit to Russia. And there's zero chance of that happening. Okay, so this idea that like America is the greatest military power that ever existed, that's literally delusional. Like, it's not a value judgment, that's just delusional. So I don't even see how you can talk about America as like a real superpower anymore. Like, because it doesn't, like, and you're already starting to see this. Like, people don't take America seriously anymore. It's like, okay, well, you're gonna, you know,
look what's happening in Africa. The fact that pissant little tiny African countries are now kicking out of the West. And France is just now capitulating because they realize that, hey, we actually don't have the manpower to present power, to enforce power in this region of the world. You go back in even the 1980s, that would never have happened. Like, they wouldn't even thought of doing it. And if some guy did think of doing it, it would have been squashed in a week.
No, like, and it's twofold. It's one part of the competency crisis. It's the second part is, I know this really interesting guy. I'm not going to like say his name, so obviously, you know, for privacy's sake, but he was in the Marine Corps, then he was in Naval Intelligence, and they deployed him to Africa, you know, and he's like, okay, well, like, what am I doing here? And these kind of make-work missions the military does now in places like Africa, it's like this kind of bastardized version of the Cold War orientation. Like, we're going to train, like, our own proxies to democratize these countries, but that doesn't make any sense outside of the Cold War. It's like, you're going to train them to do what? And to, like, fight who? Like, you know, the imaginary Soviet proxies that are trying to turn the continent red? Like, that's not a cognizable military mission. Like, you're literally just, like, sitting there doing make work and kind of irritating the local authorities. Like, that's not how you project power in an imperial way. You know, I don't mean, like, imperial in, like, the Leninist sense, but I mean, if you want to lord over, you know, the developing world in an enduring capacity, I mean, it's a combination of sticks and carrots, obviously, as regards incentives, but there's also going to be some sort of global, in, like, figurative and literal terms, concept of what you're trying to accomplish, and saying, like, we're going to make these people democratized, and by, you know, training them to fight imaginary bad guys. Like, that's not going to...
We'll make the colors just fight color revolution. Look, they're color revolutions against other colors. What's this?
No, exactly. And it comes back to the conceptual illiteracy, because, like, these guys in the Pentagon and the State Department, they're just drawing upon a precedent that they don't even really understand fully, like, from the Cold War, and, like, incompetently applying that, which is already absurd because there's not a conflict paradigm that reflects that, you know, an appropriateness to that sort of implementation. So, I mean, it's like this bizarre situation, you know, like somebody, I made the point the other day when, because, you know, even though people aren't really noticing, it's that, you know, it's 20 years since Operation Iraqi Freedom kicked off. Like, that operation didn't make any sense. Like, even if Iraq was a kind of key theater, and some kind of action had to be taken to restructure or reconfigure the political culture there, you know, just like assaulting Iraq, like, that doesn't make any sense. You know, like, militarily, that's asinine. You know, and there's not, like I said, it's not as simple as like war profiteering or whatever. I mean, yeah, there's always aspects of that, but like these people have no idea what they're doing, you know, like, whatsoever at all.
It's only rational if you see it as like a promotional campaign back home.
Yeah, exactly.
Something to, you know, raise morale by bombing the shit out of somewhere. But I mean, you see the consequences of the incompetence now, but clearly they're all just the effects of climate change. And we have obviously, I'm in Canada, and we're America's sort of retarded semi-third cousin. But if Trudeau's in, like, the G20, I think, now, and rumors from there are that basically he's being ignored. Like, people won't even talk to him. He doesn't even understand how, like, the consequences of something like freezing bank accounts of protesters, how that looks.
No, he's like some dumpy nerd with, like, a dumb tattoo who, like, you might see at, like, the bowling alley or something.
Yeah, like Superman.
yeah.
So that's my question, though, because what I'm always trying to figure out is, looking at this, however you describe the current sort of global liberal Western regime, is what's the right approach? Like, are they so dangerous that they need to be fought, or are they so stupid just let them to their own devices and try and stay don't let the building hit you on its way down?
It has to be actively resisted. I mean, in existential terms, like, it's got to be destroyed as much as communism did, and it really is just a form of communism, you know, not Marxism, but communism,
right? But is the best way to destroy it through going head on, or just backing away and
it's got to be resisted actively and on every front, and violently in battle theaters where things have already reached those conditions. I'm not suggesting people be violent here in America. I'm not suggesting people break the law at all. But no, it has to be fought on every possible front at all times. But in people's individual lives, we need to secede from it. You know, that's why my whole thing is building social capital. You know, we need to develop communitarian bonds with each other so that we can be inundated with, you know, the capital that we need practically for day-to-day life, as well as, you know, the kind of human social capital so that we can, you know, the guarantee our own posterity and our own, you know, like, literally, like, physically as well as culturally, you know, but also, you know, we need to starve the beast. Like now, the first time, I mean, I make the joke a lot that you can just like kind of pull money out of the air. And like, if I can do it, like anybody can. I mean, admittedly, I lead kind of a weird life, and I'm just like this kind of like weird writer type and stuff. But my point is that you don't need to associate with the regime, like going to college and getting some like corporate job and saying with a Fortune 500 firm and saying like, oh, I better toe the line for the sake of blah, blah, blah. Like that's not, you don't need to do that. Go be an electrician, go be a carpenter, go fucking, you know, do something whereby like your ability to generate capital is contained within, you know, what you know, what you own, and, you know, your communitarian associations. And this is all very possible right now. Mm-hmm. You know, like, don't send your kid to public school.
Yeah,
like,
more possible than ever. I mean, now is golden era for...
Don't take on $500,000 in debt to, like, keep up with the Joneses. Like, don't go work for a firm where, you know, you're gonna have to sacrifice any sort of partisan activity, you know, and basically, you know, take on at least superficially viewpoints that are a positive detriment to our people, like for the sake of, you know, being pragmatic. Like, don't do any of those things.
Yeah, if your company's doing DEI inclusion courses, just quit your job. Sorry.
Yeah, and move to a place, if you're raising a family, where, you know, people have the same sensibilities, okay? This is what people need to do. But globally, like figuratively and literally, we've got to do everything we can to destroy it. You know, because it's trying to destroy us. So it's twofold. You know, it's not one or the other; it's both.
Let's get back to the Dugin reading, because I think there's an important part of who us is, and I think people are still thinking like right, left, dissident, right, all that stuff. Us actually means humanity. Like what is being shaped here in this great reset and sort of the transhumanist, that whole the final phase of liberalism in its fulfillment. Is to destroy humanity itself.
To destroy any identitarian criteria, you know, of a historical or organic nature, and to annihilate people's ability to live historically. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. To literally like murder culture and reduce everybody to the state of a kind of deculturated, like somehow less than human natural slave. Yeah, exactly.
But no, okay, go ahead. Avoid atomization.
Yeah. Let's continue this. This is how the phenomenon of Trumpism took shape, in many ways exceeding the scale of Donald Trump's own personality. Trump played on the anti-globalization protest wave, but it is clear that he was not and is not an ideological figure. And yet it was around him that the opposition bloc began to form. The American conservative Ann Coulter, the author of the book In Trump We Trust, has since reformulated her credo to In Trumpism We Trust. Not so much Trump himself, but rather his line of opposition to the globalists has become the core of Trumpism. In his role as president, Trump was not always at the height of his own articulated task. And he was not able to accomplish anything even close to draining the swamp and defeating globalism. But in spite of this, he became the center of attention for all those who were aware or simply sensed the danger emanating from the globalist elites and the representatives of big finance and big tech inseparable from them. Thus, the core of Trumpism began to take shape. The American conservative intellectual Steve Bannon, who is an interesting figure, we should actually have a Steve Bannon.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Mark that down.
Yeah,
he's been on the list. Steve Bannon played an important role in this process, mobilizing broad segments of young people and disparate conservative movements in support of Trump. Bannon himself was inspired by serious anti-modernist authors such as Julius Evola, and his opposition to globalism and liberalism therefore had deeper roots. Let's talk about Bannon for a second, because he's an interesting little figure. Mm-hmm. Thomas, I haven't heard you talk about Bannon. Any thoughts on Herr Bannon?
He's a weird guy. You know, he was kind of the token goy at Goldman Sachs. He's like this fat Irish guy. Like, there's always one dude like that in the office of high finance. Like, I'm not kidding. There always is. But I don't want to be too hard on him because I think he's done some positive things. But he's very strange. And, you know, he funded this film, Titus, with Anthony Hopkins. And I was excited to see it when it dropped. I didn't know who the fuck Steve Bannon was at that time, because this was like, I think this was like 20 years ago.
Okay.
But the film, and Titus Andronicus is one of my favorite.
I love that movie. I saw that movie.
Okay, and
it was great.
And it's got I can't remember the dude's name. But
because it's Shakespeare, right?
Yeah, it's got Alan Cummings and it's got Anthony Hopkins, and there's this collision of aesthetics of, you know, like 1920s like fascist chic from the early days of you know, the fascist kingdom of Italy, as well as like kind of like medieval stuff, as well as, you know, like contemporary modern tech. It kind of works, it kind of doesn't, but it's interesting. But obviously, like, Bannon was you know, he fancies himself some kind of like auteur, like Renaissance man. I ended up listening to a lot of his content because, like, a lady I knew was like really into his stuff. I think some of Bannon, like Banning stuff, like Evola, was him like trying. I think he's the kind of guy probably told his assistant or whatever, like, start researching what these kids are into, like, on, you know, the kind of,
yeah,
like,
you think
so? Sphere. He's like, oh, okay, Julius Evola, yeah, like, I think that's somewhat contrived. I do not believe that, like, I don't believe Bannon is like sitting around reading stuff like that. I mean, because I was reading a book about him.
Or he was a subject of, I can't remember the book of it, but it was detailing his early life in the Navy. And apparently, this is on Bannon's account, he would seek out these books, sort of mysticism books, especially in the Far East, because I think he was positioned around Hong Kong or somewhere in the East. So he would go out and try to find these books, Evola and a few other thinkers. And he was getting into Hinduism, Buddhism, all that kind of stuff. And I think that's where he started incorporating some of these ideas at that point. So going all the way back.
I don't doubt that.
Yeah.
I don't doubt that, especially because, like, he was kicking around in the late 70s, you know, as a young man. But I don't believe Bannon is, like, sitting around, like, discussing Francis Yaki and like, hiring with people, okay? Like,
no, fair, yeah.
But the thing is, there's not the significance of Trump, again, it's not, it doesn't matter what Trump's politics are. It matters that, you know, it matters that the silent majority ossified around him, and the regime's response to him deprived the regime of any remaining legitimacy, because they simply canceled elections from then on and declared that anybody who stands in opposition to the social engineering regime, which has been in place since 1933, anybody who opposes that is just categorically evil. You know, then, like, the mask drops. So Trump caused that mask to drop, okay? That's the significance of Trump. Like, whatever... Trump from jump was not going to be able to accomplish anything, because the permanent bureaucracy of the deep state... I mean, the presidency has been somewhat gelded since Watergate. That changed a little bit under Reagan, but that owed to war and peace exigencies. But it became obvious too that, like, the regime doesn't take the presidency seriously. You know, you had these like social media clowns like deplatforming the president. You can't deplatform the president. Silicon Valley can't decide, like, we're gonna preclude the ability of the president of the United States to communicate with the American people. Like,
or if you can, then he's no longer the president.
Should have been shut down, and these people should have been arrested for that. Like, I'm not kidding.
Yeah.
Like, that'd be like if somebody tried to pull that in Eisenhower. If, like, NBC is like, we're not going to allow President Eisenhower to be broadcast here. Like, oh, really?
Well, didn't they just lock up the Proud Boys for the equivalent of not even something close? I mean, that is sedition, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, it's you know, so it's like the well, it's also too, it's like the hysterical response, like declaring over and over and over and over again that middle aged people, like, holding signs as a quote insurrection, like, there's something. That's not even good propaganda. It's just, like, hysterically retarded, you know, and, like, screaming that we're all gonna die. It's an insurrection. Like, I mean, that's not just pathetic. I mean, that's counterproductive. Like, nobody takes that seriously. To the degree it generates any response, mobilized response, it generates, like, contempt and hostility.
Yeah.
And but there's a precedent for this. I mean, living memory, you know, like, in 68, when, like, 50,000 people marched to the Pentagon and were confronted by the National Guard, like, so that's not an insurrection. Like, a handful of guys, like, mooning a statue of, like, Thomas Jefferson, like, that's like a grave crime against the government. Like, I mean, you can't. It's like, that's not even good propaganda, you know. But it's Well, the ironic thing too, not to digress, but I mean, the Proud Boys are fucking fed up anyway. Like, literally, it's like the Proud Boys, ooh, heavy. You know, yeah. Like Gavin McInnes, like that dangerous man.
Oh yeah. No, but yeah. It is interesting. I find it because like, I've always said I'm a more of a fan of Trump's fans than Trump himself, and I think maybe that the powers that be kind of view it the same way, that they're like what Coulter was saying. They're much more scared of Trumpism than the man, especially even his
Trump
rhetoric.
Himself isn't important, you know, at all. It's what, but I mean, that's the way politics always are. Like, you don't. If 70 million people declare that you're the leader of the opposition, like, that's what you are. Like, it doesn't, you know, that's what decides it. You know, like, the cunning of reason or providence, or if you don't believe in those sorts of things, you know, it's kind of like accident of fate or whatever, or, you know, the kind of the monolithic power of a majority or of a plurality opinion, you know, like, makes political figures what they are. I mean, there's exceptions, like somebody like Cromwell or Muhammad or Hitler, like they very much, I mean, they, in political terms, I mean, that's like, you know, there's like a messianic phenomena at work there. Like something like Trump or Nixon or Wallace isn't quite the same, obviously, for all kinds of reasons, but it's, you know, none of these guys the regime claimed are like fascistoid, like dangerous ideologues, like were those things. Like, frankly, in America, that wouldn't really emerge, okay? Like, the closest thing would be somebody like Andrew Jackson or Huey Long. But, like, it wouldn't, you know, but, yeah, what this is always about is it's always about the constituency or the movement or the coalition, you know, and its conceptual values. That's what it's always about. It doesn't matter. Like Trump could be like a gay, like African American midget, and like it would still be the same thing. Like it's not like Trump himself is this like far right like white guy or something. Like that's not. I mean, they might pretend that, and like really really stupid people might believe that, but that's not what it's about. I gotta I'll be right back. I gotta pop some ibuprofen and use the bathroom.
Yep, okay. Sure. All right. Thank you, buddy.
Let's go to the chat. The chat has been active. Guys, let us know what you think. Don't be shy.
That is you.
Yes, that is me. Sorry, can you hear? Or is
but it's not bad.
Okay.
It's not annoying. It's the cuteness.
It is the cuteness.
But I'd like to ask cuteness. Thomas when he gets back, because I've always wondered. The information I have on Bannon is not new and not up to date, but I remember looking into him, even sending you stuff circa 2017, because I was trying to figure out, like, is, at least at the time, it seemed like he was a better representation, or at least more closely aligned to Trumpism than Trump himself was. And I wonder how much of it was inspired by Bannon, and why isn't there a Bannonism? What's going on with him?
Because
they seem to have split ways after he was in the administration, right? And then he kind of went off, did his podcast. And is he even an active participant anymore, or just a bystander?
I haven't listened to his podcast in a while, because it's just too normy. I always clock Bannon as someone who, like Thomas said, has a surface level understanding of enough dissident thinkers that he can pull from and use their sort of like paint in broad strokes, but without really having any substance there. I think that's what I've been able to
pin my finger on. It's like, is there something here?
Sorry. I don't think there is. I think it's all, Bannon is a good strategist. So Bannon can get you into the White House, say, but then it's like, oh, then what?
Very Trump-like, yeah.
Yeah, we're just, sorry, Thomas, we're just saying, talking about, is Bannon, you know, I would say that Bannon essentially created Trumpism, more or less.
Or more than Trump, anyways.
The version that basically got him into the White House, more or less, but he's sort of like a dog chasing a fire truck. It's like, you know, he wouldn't know what to do when he got there. So as soon as he got in there, his all his strategies to get into the White House was like, well, now you succeeded. Now what? You know?
Well, it's there's a few things at work here with respect to that issue. First of all, again, like the deep state bureaucracy, I mean, that's really that, and the judiciary has really kind of been the seat of sovereignty since Watergate. With again, with the exception of Reagan, but there is complexities relating to the strategic war and peace situation that sort of altered the paradigm. But during the Obama administration, the bureaucracy was exponentially more, it was expanded and became even more permanent. Okay. So any man who found himself in the White House, unless he was able to manipulate that bureaucracy to get his way, would not be getting anything done in an executive capacity in real terms. So there's that. But also, I don't think Trump has a real policy vision. Like, I don't think it's just that Trump's not right wing or whatever. I think Trump basically is a Reaganomics supply sider. I think he believes in wielding a tariff regime in order to punish bad actors, as we saw with his disposition towards Beijing. I think he does, in fact, want like immigration reform in some basic capacity. But I think that's like the extent of like the Trump ideology. Like in foreign policy, like Trump doesn't really get why it's so insidious that the regime's making war on Russia, was making war on Syria, is slating anybody for annihilation who resists the social engineering regime. Like Trump isn't hip to any of that. Like I don't. It's not even that he doesn't like care about it. I mean, I don't think he like understands that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. I mean, Trump at the end of the day is like a media guy.
I think you're muted, Jay.
Yes, sir.
He's a permanent.
I was going to say like make 1995 relevant again. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. He's a permanent campaigner. So I mean, if there's going to be a challenge mounted to the regime by an electoral path by way of like a presidential candidate, the way it would have to play out would be a lot different. And the man slated for the role would have to be a lot more insinuated. But again, I don't think like what Trump's significance to us is that he forced the regime mask to drop. So it pissed away any remaining credibility, because now it's saying that anybody who challenges the regime, we're going to go totally berserk. We're going to try and unperson them. We're going to arrest them for protesting. We're going to indict the man who runs for president, to preclude him from seeking high office, and we're going to just cancel elections. So, I mean, that's Trump's significance. It's such that he's been a benefit to us. But, yeah, I don't it's to circle it back to the direct question. Yeah, the reason why Trump couldn't get anything done, it's twofold. I don't think he had a policy vision, but also, I mean, he was like the true seat of sovereignty is the judiciary and the permanent bureaucracy. And the permanent bureaucracy, its sole raison d'etre is the social engineering project. Okay, that's all it exists to do. So obviously it's totally facile for anybody to talk about like reforming that. That's like saying that'd be like saying in like Brezhnev Soviet Union, like, yeah, I'm gonna go to Moscow and like reform everything. Like, okay, like you do that.
Yeah, good luck. There's two in the back of your head and the back of the dash out waiting for you. Okay, let's continue with this. His opposition to globalism represents okay. An important role in Trumpism was played by consistent paleoconservatives, isolationists, and nationalists, in the likes of Buchanan, Ron Paul, as well as adherents of anti-liberal and anti-modernist, therefore fundamentally anti-globalist philosophy, such as Richard Weaver and Russell Kirk, who had been marginalized by the neocons, the globalists from the right, since the 1980s. The driving force of the mass mobilization of Trumpists came to be the networked organization QAnon, which couched its criticism of liberalism, Democrats, and globalists in the form of conspiracy theories. They spread a torrent of accusations and denunciations of globalists as involved in sex scandals, pedophilia, corruption, and Satanism.
Dugin's like showing his kind of Russianness here. Like QAnon is nothing. Like it doesn't. He's looking. Dugin's like looking at the entire kind of like internet like dissident sphere and thinking it's QAnon. Like QAnon are fucking jokers. Nobody takes seriously. And like they did not build like the Trump coalition on the ground. Like nobody gives a fuck. They're a punchline.
I think he gets to that in the next paragraph. Okay. Actually, true intuitions about the sinister nature. true institute. Fuck that.
Damn it, man.
Ideology. I was doing so well. Made evident in the latest stages of its triumphant spread over humanity, were formulated by QAnon supporters at the level of the average American and mass consciousness, which are hardly inclined towards in-depth philosophical and ideological analysis. In parallel, QAnon expanded its influence, but at the same time gave anti-liberal criticism grotesque traits. So yeah, I think what he's basically inferring here is that QAnon is doing more damage than it's helping. It's mm-hmm. it's raising a certain awareness that there's something going on, but by the way it's being done, it actually
I agree with that. They're a detriment, but they're an irrelevancy. Like there's something Rachel Maddow bandies about is like the scary boogeyman that like nobody. Like if you talk to like even the average, like if you talk to even like the average Trump supporter, like who's, you know, pretty active online or whatever, like probably he wouldn't even know what QAnon is. I mean, like it's another kind of like phantasm that the regime media establishment likes to kind of like drag out as like this scary thing that supposedly is ubiquitous and doing evil things. Like it, mm-hmm. it's
Well, I haven't heard one reasonable argument for how it was not a regime psyop.
Like, I mean, that's possible. It may very well just be crazy. I mean, frankly, there's a lot of crazy people around who develop a kind of outsized presence, particularly in online media. I mean, you may be right. I haven't like looked into it enough, but it's 24/7. I, you know, am engaged in partisan activity. And I literally go coast to coast, like meeting all kinds of people. I literally have not met a single person ever in my life who's like, yeah, QAnon, that's my thing. They're right.
Oh, yeah?
Like,
no, I've met several.
Like, I've never met a single person.
I mean, I'm in Canada, so and I've met at least a half dozen true believers who were all in.
That is interesting.
Yeah.
I mean, I've met them online, but like never in person.
No,
like,
I've met them in person. Like, I got QAnon radar. But... it's for me. It, there's certain things I always watch for, and when the message that's being projected is perfectly aligned for the other side to use to discredit you, my spidey senses just go off like crazy, and that's all QAnon. Yeah. I was like, here's the we'll give you. There'll be the truth, and then they'll Alex Jones it. Like here's something legitimate, and then they'll pack on something just crazy enough that anyone can dismiss the truth, and it's designed that way.
I'm hip to that, but. And well, it's also too, I mean, a lot of these discussions, like even people who are like nominally friendly, or at least not hostile, like they kind of, there's not only is Trump himself not this ideological figure, there's not this like elaborate ideology around Trump. Again, what the Silent Majority Coalition is it's basically like a natural response to people when they are being attacked, you know, like culturally, politically, sociologically. I mean, it's just like, you know, you're trying to eradicate our identity. You know, you're trying to force us into living conditions whereby we have no control over our own lives. You know, you're pushing totally deviant things as, you know, in order to kind of like normalize them and try and dismantle, you know, the kind of prevailing, the intimate moral core that's essential to the, you know, any kind of social cohesion. Like, this is a totally normal response. It's like saying... It'd be like a guy writing like a long dissertation on why somebody like punches back when they're punched in the face, instead of just saying like, well, when you punch people in the face, they hit you back. You know, like there's not like people like Trump because, well, there's this theory that, you know, there's adrenochrome harvesters who molest kids for space aliens who worship Satan. You know, it's like, it's not the fact that QAnon is like kind of fake as fuck anyway. It's like not like what, like I'm so the question is like, why aren't more people into Trumpism? Because I mean, like that because it's like it's such an obvious and predictable response mm-hmm. to what's underway.
Yeah,
like literally, it's not even like being, yeah. It's like, so gee, the government says, you know, sodomy is good. You know, it's good for kids to be transgendered. White people are evil. They should be a minority in this country. If you don't agree with the regime, you're a criminal. Why would people not like that? I don't know. Yeah. It must be a conspiracy theory.
Yeah, and it's not happening, but it's awesome.
Yeah.
Okay, let's continue with this. It was the QAnon supporters as the vanguard of mass conspiracy populism who led the protests on January 6th when Trump supporters stormed the Capitol outraged by the stolen election. They did not achieve any goal, but only gave Biden and the Democrats an excuse to further demonize Trumpism and all opponents of globalism. equating any conservative with extremism. A wave of arrests followed, and the most consistent New Democrats suggested that all social rights, including the ability to buy plane tickets, should be taken away from Trump supporters. Since social media is regularly monitored by supporters of the liberal elite, gathering information about almost all U.S. citizens and their political preferences posed no problem. So Biden's arrival in the White House means that liberalism has taken on, frankly, totalitarian features. And from now on, Trumpism, populism, and the defense of family values, and any hint of conservatism or disagreement with the tenets of globalist liberalism in the U.S. will be nearly equivalent to a crime, to hate speech, and fascism. There's no lies here so far. Still, Trumpism did not disappear with Biden's victory. In one way or another, it still has those who cast their votes for Donald Trump in the last election, and that is more than 70 million voters. So it's clear that Trumpism will by no means end with Trump. Half of the U.S. population has actually found itself in a position of radical opposition, and the most consistent Trumpists represent the core of the anti-globalization underground, within the citadel of globalism itself. Something similar is happening in European countries, where populist movements and parties are increasingly aware that they are dissidents deprived of all rights and subject to ideological persecution under an apparent globalist dictatorship. So you see, us dissidents were just ahead of the curve, really. It's like, yeah. Oh, you're all dissidents now. Welcome, comrades.
And also, I got to qualify the way Dugan's talking about Europe too is somewhat misplaced. Like Europe is under hostile occupation, and you get locked in prison for criticizing that regime. You know, it's not like the reason why like there's not a Donald Trump in Germany is because the Germans haven't woken up yet. It's like, well, I don't know, man. Like if you say like basically if you say like a completely uncontroversial thing about, you know, like a point of interest in history, like or if you display the wrong kind of symbol, you literally get charged with a crime in Germany. And it's like it's illegal to form an opposition party. Like there's an entire the euphemism is like the Office for the Protection of the Constitution. Like I mean it's not like you can't like the Bundesrepublik is no more of like an open political system than like the DDR was. You know, I mean, so that's you can't talk about Europe like, well, what? Why aren't they mirroring America? Or why are they? I mean, they remain occupied. If you don't believe that, I mean, America carries out terrorist assaults on its energy infrastructure to like keep it that way. Like, what the fuck is Europe gonna do? You know, I mean, that's the reason why America is continuing this occupation is because like we're at the end. Like tomorrow, like Europeans absolutely would like you know take remedial measures at the ballot box, if not through the barrel of a gun. But I just wanted to insinuate that I'm not trying to be like really hard on Dugan. I just
not at all. I think one of the things that I always keep in mind when I'm reading Dugan is I mean this book was published in 2021, I believe, and originally published in Russian for Russian readers. So there's also that idea that you know every philosopher is a propagandist for his own work. So there is he's doing basically a Western primer for a Russian audience, and reading it. So I think when you're reading it from that lens, a lot of the other stuff makes sense. Where he's condensing a lot of stuff, it's propaganda for his own work, and he's writing it for a Russian audience, basically.
No. That's fair enough.
Let's see where we at here. So it's clear that Trumpism will by no means end with Trump. Half the U.S. population has actually found itself in a position of radical opposition, and the most consistent Trumpists represent the core of its anti-globalist, European countries. So no matter how much the globalists who have retaken power in the U.S. want to present the previous 4 years as an unfortunate misunderstanding, I like that, and declare their victory as the final return to normality, the objective picture is far from the soothing spells of the globalist upper class. Not only countries with a different civilizational identity are mobilizing against it and against its ideology, but this time also half of its own population, gradually coming to realize the seriousness of its situation and beginning to search for an ideological alternative. There are conditions under which Biden has come to head the United States. American soil itself is burning under the feet of the globalists, and this gives the situation of the final battle a special additional dimension. This is not the West against the East, nor the U.S. and NATO against everyone else, but liberals against humanity, including that segment of humanity which finds itself on the territory of the West itself, but which is turning more and more away from its own global elites. This is what defines the starting conditions of this battle. We can get into Individuum next. Any closing thoughts on that Trump? Can we keep you around for a little bit longer, Thomas? We'll get into
Dugan's right final. About that. Liberalism being anti-human. Yeah, that's absolutely correct. You know, and like I'm always making the point that the 1933 regime, which is the regime we live under, it's as anti-human and at odds with reason, logos, as the Marxist-Leninist states were. Okay, in some ways, it's more insidious because it attacks the moral foundation of the person even more directly. So he's absolutely right about that, and that can't be overstated. And that's also why, I mean, with qualifications, obviously, we've got to put like our own people first, you know, like culturally, racially, confessionally. But like whoever is under assault by this by the global regime, they are our allies, if only of convenience. Okay, that can't be overstated, the tactical significance of that. But also, I mean, it's basically true, and you know there is a convergence between what justice is and what is true, and anybody like it's going to become, as the regime becomes more and more marginalized, you know, it's like we're the people who stand together, like because we're severally under assault, you know. Meanwhile, like they could, you know, all they have left is shrieking that we're all racist. When meanwhile, it's like, you know, they're conspicuous. They could, like, their ranks are made up of this kind of like, you know, conspicuous, like single tribe increasingly. Like, that's very interesting. But, I like Dugan. I think he's a good dude. And I think his books, especially his content lately, really since about 2015 or so, have been really on point. Because I'm deeply insinuated into this like partisan sphere. Like, when people overstate the significance of stuff like QAnon, I strongly object to that. Like, because I think it's slanderous of us, among other things. I know Dugan doesn't mean it that way, but that's why I take strong exception to people overstating that. That's all. This was a great conversation. I appreciate it.
Well, hang on. If we can keep you on for a little bit longer, we can get through segment, which will kind of, I think he goes directly into the post-transhumanist, post-human kind of ideas, which he's kind of laid out in the first section, and then he gets deeper into the fourth. But it's really what we're really fighting here, because I think if we're looking at this on a spectrum of just material, this is, you know, nation versus nation kind of post-war kind of idea. That's not what we're doing anymore. And I think a lot of people, especially in the Orthodox sphere, have been nailing it by saying this is a spiritual war. This is metaphysical. This is a conceptual war that is being fought not just on the battleground, but in the hearts and minds of everybody who's encountering this. And you can certainly start seeing the conflict even happening in families. And that's intentional or a direct consequence of this war becoming bigger than just tanks on a battlefield. We can put it that way.
Yeah. Well, I've always seen it as sort of like inevitable. Getting to the point that is now being the, if you seeing the conflict for what it truly is, it was building for a long time, and if it is a spiritual battle, then you can see the response from the people against the regime turning to it, seeing it as a spiritual battle because it's been a spiritual battle, and the other, a lack of spirit on one side, leading them to inevitable conclusions and goals. And then the response is inevitable on the other side, where they're going to have to take a spiritual approach to, okay, this is what's actually going on. So
I'm going to take a break and go smoke real quick.
Go ahead. Right,
yeah.
We'll talk to you
in a couple minutes. Thank you, fellas.
Let's do some chats.
Let's see. Mr. Clockwork says, Trump was the empty vehicle for widespread unspoken grievances over immigration, cultural degeneracy, American decline, and political disempowerment, and Trump played to it and grifted off of it. Yeah, I think there's some of that. I also really do believe that Trump is a patriot to a large degree. He's defending a system that got him to where he is now. Mm-hmm. So I don't think it's crazy to think that he is even on a purely selfish motivation, right, that he would be interested in preserving the system that got him to where he was and preserving it for his family. I always default to my belief that all fathers love their children. Now, I mean, they may not love them in a way that we understand, but I'll default to that before and then have someone prove me wrong. I think even Joe Biden loves his sons. It's just Joe Biden's a fucking freak, but
yeah, he's got, but, you know, that's, he's got a weird way of loving. That's it.
Yeah, well, he's very hands-on, I think.
he's practical with his affection.
Yeah. I'm sorry, my reading in Cyrillic is really rough, but...
No, but sorry, just to go back, even that last comment, like, that reminded me more of Bannon, who seems to be, whether he was plagiarizing or not, who knows, I can't read his mind, but... It seemed to be more authentic to his perspective, whereas Trump, there's a lot of words and a lot of bluster, and maybe the overall, like you said, the overall general approach is pro-American, but I don't think he would even know what that means in practical terms.
Right.
Then, well, get you jobs. You know, like, he Mr. wants Clockwork people to do well, but he doesn't have nothing. I don't think he has any clue how.
Mr. Clockwork follows up with, Marxists then make themselves god of a new utopia out of the ashes, building their paradise in a post-humanist environment. I think this is bigger than Marxism. This isn't even... Using the old terms, Marxism, fascism, all these old terms, are only useful because those are the terms being used. I think what's being born is something that's unrelated. It's going to use these systems as mind bugs to get it where it wants to, and then once it takes over, it's into a new paradigm. Something that we haven't seen yet. Mm-hmm. So when you really start following, you know, stakeholder capitalism, this weird sort of neo-corporate thing that's being pushed in the fourth industrial revolution, or all these writings from Schwab and a lot of the transhumanist literature. What they're proposing isn't Marxist.
No. If I could jump in, like the way I see it, and I could be wrong, probably am, but it's like Marxism was a fit and a start from the same engine that has moved on and left that far behind. You know, like it was a beta run of a version 1.000. And now it's like, okay, there's the same engine behind it pushing that inspired that, but it doesn't want to go back there. Like it's moved way on. I got an echo now too. Very strange.
Oh, you know what? I had to play around with the settings on StreamYard. It'll get rid of that weirdness when we play the outro, but it might actually introduce a bit of an echo in there because I had to take echo cancellation. I don't know. Anyways, yeah, that's boring for the stream. Sorry, guys.
Sorry. I gotta say.
I will plug. Let's plug our Patreon. We have a Patreon. Go support the channel if you like content like this. We ask for $5 minimum. You can of course give more if you like. We have a few subscribers over there. Always like, subscribe, and share out the channel. We are getting there, folks. Slowly and surely, we are going. I kind of like the way we've been developing, especially on YouTube, because it feels like we're in enemy territory. There's ways we could structure a lot of these shows, especially with Friend or Fed. I know the way to do Friend or Fed in a way that would get us a million views. Unfortunately, it'd be a million low-quality, low-res people, you know, coming in to see a blood sport kind of thing, yeah. Which I'm not interested in doing whatsoever. Not just because... yeah, no, screw all that. I would much rather remain smaller with a high quality audience like we have watching us today, rather than get millions and millions of low quality views and then have to deal with all that rigmarole. Yeah. So,
well, I think we both always agreed we'd rather make quality content than put on a performance.
Absolutely.
And if it's a slow, long build, we'll take that over something where you gotta be jumping through hoops and lighting your hair on fire. It's not our brand.
Welcome back, Thomas. We will get right into this because I don't want to keep you forever, Tom. But I think this is going to address some of the more major points. Mark, did you need to go and do anything?
No, I'm good for a few.
Okay. Individuum and dividium. One of the more essential points needs to be made clear. We have seen that the entire history of liberalism is the successive liberation of the individual from all forms of collective identity. The final accord in the process of this logically perfect implementation of nominalism will be the transition to posthumanism and the probable replacement of humanity with another, this time posthuman, machine civilization. Consistent individualism taken as something absolute leads to. But here liberal philosophy arrives at a fundamental paradox. The liberation of the individual from his human identity, for which gender politics prepares him by consciously and purposely transforming the human being into a perverted monster, cannot guarantee that this new progressive will remain an individual. Moreover, the development of network computer technologies, genetic engineering, and object-oriented ontology itself, which represents a culmination of postmodernism, clearly points to the fact that the new being will not be so much an animal as a machine. It is with this in mind that the horizons of immortality are likely to be offered in the form of artificial preservation of personal memories, which are quite easy to stimulate. Stop me anytime, folks.
Yeah.
No, I was gonna. See, there's a few things going on here. I agree with them in the capital P progressive tradition. Okay, like the liberation from matter. Okay, that's kind of the ultimate like ontological conclusion. Okay. However, liberalism, as people invoke the term, as shorthand for like regime values today, that's not really the same thing. Like, these people are total Luddites. Like, as much as they talk about, like, trust the science, they're terrified of science. They're terrified of nuclear power. They're terrified of high tech. They don't understand it. It's like ghost stories to them. Like, they don't want to, like, suppress sexuality and, like, remove it from the equation. They want it to become, like, just this, like, fetishistic masturbatory thing that's fundamentally important to human life. Like, they're trying to turn man into like an animal. They're not like this is like debased animal. Like, their goal isn't like, we've got to do away with, you know, the corruption of the flesh, you know. Like, I do agree with them that like the true transhumanists, yeah, their ambition absolutely is to upload, like, literally like upload consciousness to some artificial vessel and like then like be free of like the prison of matter, like, and be a god. Okay, like, and that might sound ridiculous. That's literally what these people think.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the logical conclusion of their conceptual horizon. But there's nothing nearly that grandiose or like well thought out or complex about the ambition of the regime. Like, these guys just want to just like carry on and be hysterical and have sex with everything. Like, they really are.
Babel, right? Like, yeah, I want to go up there.
Well, hang on. High-minded ideas meet with low-level passions, and it's like,
yeah, but I mean,
there be so monsters.
Like, the regime, like, what's ultimately going to do the regime in is that it's just going to become, you know, the Ponzi craze is going to reach the point that, I mean, I think America will exist in terms of a political entity, like a discrete political entity with like parameters of authority and like formal office and stuff. That'll probably endure for like 3 or 4 centuries, but by that point it'll be indistinguishable from any like third world regime. You know, like, no one will really take it seriously. It'll be too corrupt to really, you know, impose its ambitions at scale. You know, like, it's probably going to look kind of like South Africa or something. And like, men who actually do wield power, have like their own police force, have their own protection element, you know, they'll kind of like live parallel lives that don't really intersect with officialdom. Like, that's what we're looking at. You know, we're not looking at this dystopia where these guys have kind of they have this kind of like ontological dream that something like Arthur C. Clarke had, you know, whereby like, you know, we can eradicate the prison of matter and do away with all these kinds of human traits that, you know, hold us back from, you know, evolution. Like, that's not their drive. Like, they're like a bunch of fucking monkeys. You know, they're not like twisted geniuses. They're literally fucking monkeys. I mean,
they don't want to build Star Wars. They want to build a tower to heaven and then fuck on top of it.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, I just wanted to insinuate that.
Let's get through there. Thus, the individual of the future, as the fulfillment of the whole program of liberalism, will not be able to guarantee precisely which has been the main goal of liberal progress, that is, their individuality. The liberal being of the future, even in theory, is not an individuum, something indivisible, but rather a dividium, i.e. something divisible and made up of replaceable parts, such as the machine. It is composed of a combination of parts. In theoretical physics, there has long been a transition from the theory of atoms, i.e. the indivisible units of matter, to the theory of particles, which are thought of not as parts of something whole, but as parts without a whole. The individual as a whole also decomposes into component parts, which can be reassembled, but can also not be assembled.
That's important. That's important. And Wolfgang Smith gets into that. Like the whole idea of any irreducible entity is done away with in favor of quantum stock. And that's not a value neutral postulate. That's very insidious. And this is what populates like the value system of what remains the liberal intelligentsia, like capital L.
It's the inversion. It's the inversion of the Trinity.
Yes, sir.
And it's how let's get theological for a second. I even my conversion over to Orthodoxy, I always thought the Trinity conversation to be a bit of like a theological, you know, what's it nuts? You know, like it's like, okay, well, sure, you know. And then I was reading Blessed Sarah from Rose and kind of starting to see the extension of all this. And then I became really aware that if you get the Trinity wrong, you get everything else wrong. You get reality wrong. Like it changed our fundamental concept of reality to such a degree that we're still just catching up to it 2,000 years from now. The idea of a non-created, non-divisible oneness that is represented in three parts. And we can see this throughout physics. You know, the idea that that light is both visible, a wave, and a particle, all formatting into one thing, is a massive formation to our modernist science. 100%. And what this looks like, at least on paper, is or how Dugin is presenting it, is the inversion of that Trinity of simply saying, no, we can pull these things apart and itemize them and have three separate things.
And we
can
figure them any way we want. Yeah.
Right. And it's like, no, you can't. Well, you can try, and you might get some limited successes, but you're also going to get,
you can make really, really, really big explosions.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, I'm getting facetious, but yes, no, that's absolutely, man. Very, very well said.
Let's do that again. The individual as a whole also decomposes into component parts, which can be reassembled, but can also not be assembled, but instead uses a bioconstructor. Hence the figures of mutants, chimeras, and monsters that abound in modern fiction, populating the most imagined, and therefore in a sense anticipated and even planned, versions of the future. There, Jonathan Pageau does a great. If you go after this, guys, go Google Jonathan Pageau's talks on chimeras. He does some really good ideas about that, especially from a orthodox lens. The postmodernists and speculative realists have already prepared the ground for this by proposing to replace the human body as something whole with the idea of a parliament of organs by B. Latour. This is the first time I'm hearing this. In this way, the individual, even as a biological unit, would become something else, mutating precisely the moment it reaches its absolute embodiment. Human progress in liberal interpretation inevitably leads with the abolition of humanity. This is what all those taking up the fight against globalism and liberalism suspect, albeit very vaguely, although QAnon and their anti-liberal conspiracy theories only distort reality by lending suspect, grotesque traits which liberals can easily refute, reality, when described soberly and objectively, is far more frightening than its most alarming and monstrous premonitions. The Great Reset is indeed a plan for the elimination of humanity. For this, it is precisely the conclusion that the line of liberally understood progress logically leads to. Striving to free the individual from all forms of collective identity cannot fail to result in the freeing of the individual from himself. thoughts.
Yeah, that, I mean, that's, I agree. I mean, I, like I said, I agree basically with what Dugan, like how he describes the situation and existentially, you know, what that entails for a man as an individual, as well as, you know, at scale as a constituent element of a culture, race, and civilization. He's absolutely right about those things. Any political or historical writer or any sociological writer, he's going to have his own kind of discrete emphases. I mean, me, maybe it's because I got like a legal background. I tend to focus on the parameters of juristic things, structures, and how they're configured, you know, and how that, you know, imposes an ordering mechanism on people at scale within the sovereign domain of a regime, you know, and specifically our regime. But the degree to which what we live under now, it's not just some like perversion of like, you know, of John Locke and Thomas Paine or something. Like, I'm not even saying like these guys were like great thinkers anyway, we should emulate, but it's what happened in America in 1933 was as revolutionary as what happened in the Soviet Union and under the Russian Revolution, you know, and the National Socialist Revolution, which was a legal revolution, you know, not one like outside the parameters of law and order, but you know, it was just as much a revolutionary paradigm as occurred in Russia and as in Europe, okay, and that endures to this day. So, you know, this idea of stripping people down to this kind of base element, you know, who's characterized, you know, simply by, you know, appetites and things. That's not just like the legacy of, you know, a school of thought and conceptual horizon that like began with Hobbes and like ends with, you know, and ends with Schwab. Yeah, you know, like it's a revolutionary imperative that very much owes to the kind of conceits and preferences and priorities of the 20th century. It's very much framed by ethno-sectarian hostilities. It's very much something that's not very well precedented. Yeah, it draws upon what came before, because there's nothing that's truly, you know, like without precedent in the human experience that becomes, you know, like a dominant ideology. You know, like nothing is just kind of like confabulated out of whole cloth with like literally without reference to precedent. But that's a really important point. That's why, like this, that's why I'm writing this long form book on the Nuremberg trials. I'm not just rehashing, you know, the procedural aspects and relaying the facts, you know, like according to my own emphases and priorities. Like the trial itself isn't even the emphasis of it. It's the system that it created and how that system is impactful on human lives far, far, far beyond, you know, power political terms and, you know, the affairs of nations at war and at peace. Like it touches and concerns every aspect of human existence and political and social life. And even more deeper than that, you know, it deals with the most intimate of matters to the individual, you know, like relating to things like sexuality and heritage and physical and like biological race, literally, as well as cultural heritage that's less tangible. That's a hugely important point. I mean, not just for, you know, not just because it's trivia or not just because like, it helps bring these things kind of into like high relief, proverbially speaking, but it also is to show like the degree to which we are under assault and have been for a century in earnest. Okay. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of my jive. I got to raise up in a minute, man. Is there anybody in chats who wants me to answer anything?
Any questions for Thomas? Now is the time before I play the outro music.
I think that's it. Yeah, but I like where you're getting at there, Thomas, because to me, I'd have to read a paragraph like that about six times for my 110 brain to fully absorb it. But
no, I was probably rambling, man. It's not that I'm so heavy. I think it's more that like I'm tired and I was rambling. But yeah.
But yeah, my question, because I'm going there, like where I go eventually is like, this makes total sense for someone, for something like this to be imposed from outside on a people that you want to destroy, but from inside.
I really like that light jazz. I'm listening.
Huh?
I like the jazz outfit.
It's a nice one, isn't it?
Yeah. No, go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, that's it. That was my whole thought. Like, okay, this is a great attack strategy, but why are the leaders in the West implementing this self-destruction out of blindness or malice? And we'll move on to that at another point. But I'd like to try and figure that out. What is the impetus for people from
it's both? If it was neither, and it depends on what faction you're talking about. But yeah, we can take that up in another pod if you want.
Thomas, plug your stuff.
Anytime.
Okay, yeah, you can always find me on my website. It's thomas777.com, number 7, H-O-M-A-S, 777.com. It's still under construction, but it is populated by my content. That's like a one-stop shop for stuff that I do. You can find my Substack and the podcast at realthomas777.substack.com. You can find me on X, like formerly Twitter, at Real capital REAL _ number 7 HMS 777. You can find me on Tgram at ThomasGram 777. Again, number 7 HMS 777 Gram. And the channel, which I was just in Utah filming for in earnest, you can find me at Thomas TV on YouTube, number 7 HMS space TV. I think that's all I got for now. Oh, and I got like long form stuff on the way. Steelstorm 3, as well as a Nuremberg book. Hopefully by March, one of those will drop.
Thank you, folks.
Very cool.
As always, thanks, Thomas. We'll talk to you guys soon.